This is Dr. Z, Zachary Brooks, and welcome to part two of the interview with Dr. Tony Stovall, who studies the right to consume as a clinical associate professor of marketing at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis. There's an overlap of about 10 seconds. We can pick up right where we left off in the people behind the PhDs. How many schools did you apply to altogether? Was it just Berkeley and Stanford?
No, I applied to five. It was Berkeley, Stanford, Duke, Northwestern, and Princeton.
Okay. So five small colleges you may have heard of in life.
Yes, you might have heard of them in your goings about.
Okay. So tell us about the day that you found out where you're going to go to college.
It was, I got into Stanford and I was just so excited. It's like, oh my God, my dream is going to come true. And then I think I got Stanford first, and then I got into Duke and Northwestern, and I was like, yeah, whatever. That's fine.
Embarrassment of riches.
Exactly. And then the Princeton admission came right after that. And so I'm like, oh my gosh, I got into Princeton. How do I say no?
Sure.
You don't say no to Princeton. Oh my gosh. But it's like, but no, I want to go to Stanford. And so, and then I realized it's like, okay, we were in Nebraska at the time. So we were dead center of the country. And, I said, okay, I want to go somewhere where my parents can't get in the car and drive there the same day and say, knock on my dorm room door and say, surprise. So I applied to the coast.
Yeah.
And Northwestern in Chicago, which is about a 9-10 hour drive from Omaha, was the closest school that I applied to.
Okay.
I got into Princeton, and they actually had a representative from Princeton who lived in Omaha come by the house.
Wow.
And stop in and say, hey, we're just wondering if you had any questions. And I was like, no, I'm going to Stanford, thanks.
The farm.
Oh, wow.
So I knew, like I said, that's where I wanted to go, and I got in. And so I also, having, been in Nebraska for high school, I was like, I don't want to live anywhere cold.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like, okay, well, that really, seals the deal. It's like, I'm definitely going to Stanford then.
So you obviously wanted to go to Stanford, but one of your concerns was your parents' ability to drive there in a day, you said?
I didn't want them to be able to get in the car and drive there the same day.
And what branch of the military was your father in?
Air Force.
So, I guess you realized at the time that your dad did have access to a plane. He could get there just as easily in a day.
Yes, but we never flew. Like, all our vacations, we never flew anywhere. We always, always drove.
Okay, no problems.
Because he flew in planes for his livelihood, he didn't want to do that on a vacation. That probably felt like work to him.
Okay, I just kind of imagined your father saying, hey, let's go see Tony, and just get in the plane and show up, and we'll be there in a quick day anyway. I was imagining.
They didn't do that.
Okay. So anyway, you're at Stanford. You're on the farm. So anyone who doesn't know, Stanford's nickname is called The Farm. So you're on the farm in Palo Alto, California. Your dream had come true. At this point, your life is completely on a straightward up trajectory, correct?
Right.
What was your experience like at Stanford? What did you study?
I majored in international relations.
Okay.
Because I knew that as an international relations major, we call it IR for short, you were required to study overseas.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know, or I didn't think my dad would let me go any other way.
Mm-hmm.
Other than say, but I have to, Dad. It's my major. It's required.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I majored in that. I went to Spain. I studied in Spain for a summer in Madrid. And it was fantastic. And I have the best relationships, in the world. It's like I still am closest to the people from my freshman dorm.
Mm.
I still am in contact with my freshman roommate. We're still very close. And, my best friend to this day is somebody that I met on the first day of freshman orientation.
Oh, wow. That's fantastic. Who's that person? What's their name?
His name is Lawrence Shorter.
Hi, Lawrence. Thanks for being a great friend of Tony. That's a really cool story already. And so,
yes.
Was there any sort of monumental sort of moments to stand out for you at Stanford? Obviously, your first day as a freshman, but you know, during your course of studies, and you went to Spain, you had some great experiences already. Were anything that could have stood out as a turning point in your life that, you know, at least at that point made you think, okay, I really want to study something, or I really want to pursue something that you saw or experienced when you were at Stanford?
Right. Sure. Well, one of the things, you know, it's like I was, you know, public school, product of the public schools of Bellevue, Nebraska, you know, which is fantastic, got a great education. But it did not in any way, shape, or form prepare me for the rigors of Stanford.
Okay.
And it was, you know, it was quite a shock to the ego when you get there. You know, in high school, you're pretty much one of the smartest people in the room. You
mm-hmm.
knew pretty much any classroom, yep, I'm one or two or three as far as levels of intelligence of people in the room.
Okay.
It's like then you get to a school like Stanford and everybody is at that level,
mm-hmm.
if not beyond. So, you know, you get into classes and you're struggling with calculus. Your introductory calculus class, and there are people who've in high school have already had 3 years of calculus.
Yeah.
You know, your freshman English reading, it's like they've already. Oh yeah, we've already read that already. You know, I read that in my junior year of high school.
Mm-hmm.
So you're at a school, you know, one of the quote-unquote elite institutions with people who've been to boarding school, prep schools, all of these kinds of things, and have had exposure to the curriculum that you're just getting your first introduction to, and it's very, very, very overwhelming.
Wow.
And for so many, it's like, you know, you get in high school, it's like, you know, it was relatively easy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's pretty much rote memorization, and I was really good. I had a really good memory. I could do that. Didn't ever have to study, really.
Yeah. And now you're suddenly...
Naturally. Exactly. Now you get to Stanford, and you're like, you know, oh, I can write a paper the night before, and you stay up and type your paper, and then you turn it in, and it's like you get a C, and you're like, excuse me.
Yeah.
I think you misgraded this. I don't give C's on papers. And like, well, you do now.
Yeah. So a lot of imposter syndrome at the freshman level, it sounds like.
Oh, exactly. And then, you know, you start to question, it's like, do I belong here? It's like, why? What? Like, how did I get here? This is a fluke. You know, what do I do? And, you know, it's like you didn't have study skills. You know, I didn't know how to study. I didn't know what to do. If I didn't understand the material, it's like, okay, fine. So... for me, you know, it's like it's in hindsight, I realized how detrimental it was. But for me at the time, I just decided, oh, I'm going to take my ball and go home.
Okay. So you left Stanford?
I didn't leave Stanford.
Okay.
I just, as far as, I won't say checked out academically, but I was like, okay, whatever. I'll just do the bare minimum to get by.
Okay. Because so this blow to your ego, I mean, it's... you're able to hold on, but, you know, the way you kind of dealt with it is like, okay, I'm going to do the bare minimum, just get through this.
Right, exactly.
I mean,
I finished on time. I didn't take extra time, so I graduated in 4 years. But it was still very much, you know, I look back now at my GPA and I'm like, oh my gosh, okay, wow.
This People Behind the PhDs episode is sponsored by Harp Concepts. Are you an up-and-coming artist with a bright idea? Are you a startup company who needs to prove your concept? Or are you a person who likes to personalize special gifts? Harp Concepts makes high-quality 3D models for a fraction of the price of big-name companies. Learn more at harpconcepts.com. That's harpconcepts.com. If you could have applied yourself more, you could have done different. You could have done things differently later.
Absolutely, I could have done exactly. I could have done much, much, much better.
Okay.
And I think so. You know, I think part of my drive to get a PhD was in response to having done so poorly at the undergraduate level and realizing it's like, you know, having to prove one to myself. It's like, no, I am smart. I did deserve to be there. I just didn't apply myself.
Well, sort of like the circuli in the brain, which are folds, basically. Your life has these folds. And so it almost seems like, in retrospect, you had to go through this ego-bursting time, get through it, and then be motivated the rest of your life to get back to that. You know, like your entire life is passing through multiple, sort of binary dimensions.
Yeah.
In retrospect, like, of course you're not going to do great after getting there, because it's going to motivate you later. To do even better, to actually get a PhD later. So get through Stanford. So did you immediately become an XFL right-hand man for cheerleaders?
No. So when I was at Stanford, actually, I became interested in more in the arts. I didn't do band. I don't know if you're familiar with the Stanford band, but they are very, very unconventional.
Mm-hmm.
They just, run around on the field haphazardly and get into a formation, and it's not marching anything traditional that I was used to. And so I went to practice, when I first got there freshman year, and I was like, there is no way I'm doing this.
Okay.
I don't understand this. This is ridiculous. Oh my gosh, they are desecrating the name of band. So I said, nope, I'm not having anything to do with this.
So it was like chaos theory applied to band management?
Exactly. And I was like, nope. This is not me. I can't do this. This is blasphemy.
Okay.
Right? So I needed an artistic outlet. So my good friend that I mentioned earlier, Lauren Shorter, and I, we started an a cappella singing group.
Okay.
And at the time, it's like we were the first basically racially diverse a cappella group at Stanford.
Okay.
It had other groups before, but they were pretty much monochromatic, if I can say that.
Okay.
As far as the racial makeup of the group. So we started a group called Everyday People.
Okay.
And it is still going to this day, more than 30 years later.
Oh my goodness. So first of all, for people who don't know, what does a cappella mean?
It means basically you're singing without instruments.
Okay. And so there was...
So your voices are making all of the, what you would hear as instrumental, like the voice, you have voices that are making all of those sounds.
Excellent. Okay,
so
and there was...
If you've heard of Pentatonics, if you've heard of that group, that is a cappella.
Okay. And there was two of you in the band?
No, two of us started it. We had 16 people in the group.
Oh, okay. And so you had... You said it was the first multiracial a cappella group on...
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah, so that's how... So I started that, and I started doing that artistically. And then during that time, I got bitten by the, as they say, the stage bug, and I was, this is it, I want to be a performer.
Okay.
So,
to be or not to be? That is the question.
So when I graduated from Stanford, I decided that I was going to be a performer. So I went to American Conservatory Theater in San Francisco.
Yeah.
They have a summer acting program.
Yeah, it's a fantastic place, absolutely.
Yes. And I went, so I did that, I did their summer program. And at the time I was living in San Francisco and doing basically some temp work. And offices, basically doing marketing stuff, marketing material. And my roommate's girlfriend at the time was going to school. She was getting her PhD at the University of Chicago.
Okay. But she was in San Francisco for the summer?
She came back during one of her spring breaks.
Okay. Now, so
she
just
came and stayed with him.
So just to orient myself a little bit, so now you finished with Stanford, now you're living in the city in San Francisco. And this is sort of like mid-90s. What time frame is this?
This was 90, basic 90s.
90s, okay,
early
got
90s,
it.
So
early
yeah,
90s,
so
okay.
90, yeah.
Right at the precipice of the Silicon Valley launch, as we know Silicon Valley to be now, which is the launch of all this technology and internet and the rest of it. Okay, so right at
exactly.
that moment, got it.
Exactly. So, and I decided, she said, if you want to do acting, because from Chicago, for people who don't know, is a hotbed of acting. Like, there is a lot of acting. Many, many New York actors and LA actors come from Chicago.
Yeah, Second City is one of them, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So I said, okay, this is what I want to do. So I moved to LA to become famous, you know, rich and famous. And that was very, very short-lived.
So L.A. did not welcome you with open arms? Is that what you're saying?
They did not. L.A. did not. And that's...
That's so unusual for L.A.
It really is. You know, people think all these overnight sensations, and, you know, that rarely, rarely, rarely happens. And L.A. will eat you up and spit you out really quickly. It's like I tell people who want to move to L.A., it's like, okay, even if they're not acting... It's going to take you 2 years to acclimate to this place,
mm-hmm.
to figure it out, to understand how the ebb and flow works. And especially if you're in the industry, it's like you really have to have the tenacity to be able to hang on and to be able to support yourself during those lean times. Because just starting, it is going to be very, 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 very lean.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was there probably about a year.
Okay.
And then I said, okay, this isn't working. So I moved back to San Francisco.
Okay.
And just was working. And I was doing some theater here and there when I could. And then I was like, no, I really, really, really want to do this. And the roommate at the time, his girlfriend said, you know, you should really think about Chicago.
This People Behind the PhDs episode is sponsored by Harp Concepts. Are you an up-and-coming artist with a bright idea? Are you a startup company who needs to prove your concept? Or are you a person who likes to personalize special gifts? Harp Concepts makes high-quality 3D models for a fraction of the price of big-name companies. Learn more at harpconcepts.com. That's harpconcepts.com. Okay.
It's less, you know, it's more manageable than New York, but the theater scene is, it's a lot more experimental, a lot more avant-garde. There's a lot of new and up-and-coming theaters that are going on, and so there's a lot of work for actors who are just starting.
Yeah, so in many ways, it's an optimal place for actors to start because there's enough opportunities, but it's enough under the radar that you can make lots of mistakes while you're honing your craft.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Absolutely. That's a perfect example. So I did that, and I was in Chicago for acting and doing some musical theater, but not much. Mostly I was doing Shakespeare and straight plays in Chicago.
Okay.
And then one year I was just, you know, I was walking down the street. It was winter, and it was minus 60 with the wind chill. That's it. I'm out of here. I am not doing this anymore. I'm done. I don't care. I can't. This cold is unbearable.
So in the course of human history, how many Chicago stories have ended exactly that way? You know, that day, how many people were on the same street at the same time you were, and their Chicago story ended right then and there, just like you? How many people do you think?
Oh, I mean, it's a lot, but then, you know, you think about how many people live in Chicago, and it's like, why? I don't understand. Like, that first winter, it's like, I don't understand why the people, the original settlers, didn't say, all right, let's pack it in, we're gone.
Okay. But obviously, they didn't, so.
Yes, exactly. So, I did that, and while I was in Chicago, I actually, to support myself, that's when I started working in IT.
Okay.
I got sent on a temp job to Encyclopedia Britannica.
Oh, okay.
And so I worked there, and they said, we just need somebody for technical. They were technical support for the CD-ROM. They had just come out with a CD-ROM product.
Okay.
If we remember what those are, like, oh, so long ago.
They look a lot like DVDs, correct?
Exactly. It's similar to a DVD. But they have the encyclopedia on CD-ROM.
Okay.
So they needed somebody for support for that product. And I told them, I told the agency, I said, I don't know anything about this. Nothing at all. Just go for a week or so. We just want to keep the account.
Got it.
Just basically go be the seat warmer. So until we can find somebody who can actually do this. I was like, okay, fine, fine. So I went. And I actually found, oh, I can do this. Okay, this is interesting. It's not easy, but it was very logical, and my brain works that way.
Yeah, well, you're the kid in high school that always had a book in his hand, so.
Exactly. So I understood. I was like, okay, if this, I would talk to people that basically worked on the technical support on the helpline, and so people would call in with a problem, and I said, okay, well, if this is what's happening, it can only be two things. Right? It can only be this or this. A computer only, does what it does in the manner that it does, and it doesn't deviate from that. So if this is the problem, then these are the only two causes. So I was able to grasp it quickly,
mm-hmm.
and so I stayed there for 4 years working at Encyclopedia Britannica. Yeah,
in Chicago.
That was when I decided that in Chicago. That was when I decided, okay, that's it. It's too cold. So then I moved back to LA.
Really?
And I just needed to be warm. It's like I didn't necessarily want to pursue acting in LA, but I just had to be warm.
Okay.
And that was where I knew I had friends there, so I moved there.
So before we kind of continue, so for anyone who doesn't know, I mean, it sounds really silly now, these CD-ROMs, but it was so revolutionary at the moment because we went from, 25 books or whatever that would hold, a distillation of all the world's knowledge in an encyclopedia to basically a disc. And so that's why it was revolutionary, able to squeeze all of this information digitally onto a disc size. Now it's, distributed differently over Web 2.0 and other sort of ways. But that's why this is such a big deal at the moment. Tony was in this location in this point of time. So anyway.
Exactly.
Okay, so you're back in L.A. What did you do in L.A.?
Yeah, and just to piggyback on what you were just saying, it's like that really fostered my interest in the whole digital electronic market world and the whole digital disruption that's happening.
Okay.
And that was happening at the time. So then I moved to L.A. This had been the second time I had been in L.A. And like I said, didn't necessarily want to act, but I still had that bug. And so I said, okay, well, if I want to do this, I still need to find a temp job that will let me go on auditions and these kinds of things. So I found another job doing IT technical support.
Okay.
And this time, this was at Korn Ferry International.
Okay.
Which is the world's premier executive search firm.
Got it.
So I was there working IT. And then I started to act some more on the side, do musical theater in L.A. But again, it really wasn't happening.
Mm-hmm.
And so at that point, realism kicked in.
Okay.
And, it's like, okay, maybe this isn't going to happen, which is, and I was okay with that. So I said, so what can I do that will let me use the skill set I already have and be able to move past that and be able to fashion a career out of this.
Sure.
So at the time I said, okay, well, while I'm doing this, like I need another job because at this point I was so far into IT. I was like, if I continue down this road, the career trajectory is to be the CIO, the Chief Information Officer, or the CTO, Chief Technology Officer of a company. I think, and I had absolutely no desire to do that.
Okay, you didn't want to take technology that far for yourself.
No, I did not.
And so just
not to be a lifelong career and be, in the C-suite doing that.
So, and just so time frame wise, this is like late 90s, early 2000s you came back to LA?
Yes.
Okay.
So then in 2000.
In 2000, exactly.
In 1999.
Okay.
Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah. So I came back to LA. I was working. So I decided at that point, I said, okay, what do I do? I need a different job, but at that point I'd been in IT for so long, like what kind of job am I going to get? Who's going to let me do what I want to do? So I decided to go get an MBA.
Okay.
I said, that will let me make the career switch, a transition from IT to something else, to management, to marketing, to whatever.
Okay.
So I did that.
So where did you apply and where did you get in? Thanks for listening to part two of the interview with Dr. Tony Stovall, who studies the right to consumption at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis. To continue listening, visit drz.net. That's dr-z.net. You can also follow me on Facebook at Dr. Z Podcasts and Instagram at drznet. As always, happy deciding.